Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table,
a new United Methodist community of faith taking shape at Central UMC in Sacramento, California.
The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Duhirsu,
with a musical introduction by Anthony Coleman, our director of music.
Thanks for listening.
Our reading this morning comes from the 12th chapter of John, and I'll be reading verses 20 through 33. Now among those who went up to worship at the festival were some Greeks. They came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, and said to him, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." Philip went and told Andrew, then Andrew and Philip went and told Jesus, and Jesus answered them, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Very truly, I tell you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains just a single grain. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Those who love their life lose it, and those who hate their life in this world will keep it for eternal life. Whoever serves me must follow me, and where I am, there will my servant be also. Whoever serves me, the Father will honor. Now my soul is troubled. And what should I say? Father, save me from this hour. No, it is for this reason that I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name." Then a voice came from heaven. "I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again." The crowd standing there heard it and said that it was thunder. Others said an angel had spoken to him. And Jesus answered, "This voice has come for your sake, not for mine. Now is the judgment of this world. Now the ruler of this world will be driven out, and I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself." He said this to indicate the kind of death he was to die.
You can pray with all your might till your knuckles all turn white. You can look the other way, hope it's gone with each new day. You can do your best to hide, you can hold it all inside. You can curse and shake your fist, you can ask, "Why God, why this?" There is peace somewhere, I'm told. There's a fire out in the cold. There are wonders to behold in the dark night of the soul.
Each week we have looked at a person's life and framed it around one of our words of how we might be broken open by Jesus and become closer to God. The unique thing about our person today is that she's alive. There she is. Her name's Lorenza Andrade Smith. I haven't physically met her. I've only met her on Facebook. She has a page, and you can friend her if you want. Lorenza is an ordained United Methodist pastor out of the Rio Grande Annual Conference, which is in Texas. She's small. Like Vanessa Small. She has this long, beautiful, dark hair, and she's in her 40s. On her Facebook page, she has something that she started, which she calls Pictures with Tall People. So if you do befriend her and you start following her, what you notice is you see her in every picture, and then you see the rest of the world to, like, here, literally. And somebody wrote, "Do you always hang out with basketball players?" And she said, "No, I'm just really that short." So there's a theme there. She's intelligent, she's well-spoken, she's very engaging. I've watched videos of her. She exudes authenticity when she speaks. She's very funny, but she's also very serious, especially when it comes to talking to us about her call to ministry with those who live on the margins of our society. She follows Jesus, and Lorenza is intentionally homeless. She was born on the border of the United States in Brownsville, Texas, right there. Her mom was a Methodist and her dad was a Catholic. She said they spoke to her in Spanish and she would answer in English, therefore she cannot speak either very well. She married a European American Baptist. They have a son who has entered the Muslim world. He's 18 and he's going to be married this June. Lorenza graduated from seminary and was appointed to Westlawn United Methodist Church right out of seminary. That's in San Antonio, Texas. And soon, very soon, she was very captivated about the issues of injustice that were there in their community, and she became an outspoken advocate. And she joined other groups, not just in her church, but in her community and then in the larger church community outside her annual conference. She served two other churches, but last July, 2011, at her own request, she was appointed by her bishop. That's how Matt and I are rooted here in this church. Our bishops appoint us to a charge. She was appointed by her bishop to a ministry of the streets. In the spring before that, she started to divest herself of her possessions. She sold her home. She gave away everything or sold it. She said the only thing that she really couldn't part with were, can you guess? Photographs. So she gave those to the care of family members. Now she has a backpack. It holds a Bible, a chalice, and a plate for communion, and a few other little items. She sleeps on the street or in homeless shelters, and sometimes she spends time in jail. This photo was taken actually before she was appointed to a ministry on the streets. She was being arrested, having just been removed from Texas Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison's office there in San Antonio. The senator withdrew her support for the DREAM Act. For those of us who don't know what the DREAM Act is, it's legislation that would provide a path to citizenship for students brought here to this country before they're 16 years old. So many people in solidarity with those who are undocumented in our country are protesting this and trying to get legislation passed. And so there was a peaceful demonstration there in Senator Hutchison's office, who had supported the act but changed her mind. In talking about this particular arrest, Lorenza said that those who were arrested with her and were going to jail, actually a lot of them had jobs and they were students. They were students in solidarity with other students. And so they couldn't really stay in jail. And she said, "I was just a pastor. I didn't really have a job, so I was going to stay in jail." And she did that because she trusted and they trusted her that by so doing, she would represent them in jail. She didn't know anything about jail then. She'd never been before. And as you can see, in part, she wore that into jail. What you don't see is she had on a skirt and high heels, no stockings. That's important because she found out really quickly It's very cold in jail. And if you wear high heels, they take them from you because those stilettos can really be weapons, apparently. So she was barefoot in a cold jail. And she said, at that moment, I realized I was standing on holy ground. From that initial detention center where they took people from Senator Hutchison's office, they shackled her at her wrists and at her feet and transferred her to a county jail. And that is where she actually was held until her time before the judge when she was arraigned for her sentencing. She found out, she said, that there was not much in the jail, in county jail. In other words, there were bunks. That was about it. Everything was open. No walls, no partitions. So there were bunks and toilets. That's what was there. The men and the women are separated. The beds, by the time she got there, were mostly full, so she had to go all the way in the back. And she found a bed with the other women. There was one other thing in the jail, a television, though. And she was there at night. You can see that it was late. And so the news was on. So there she was in the jail, and the news came on, and guess what picture was on the news? So they figured out who she was, and the guards moved her to the front. Still with the women, but they moved her much more to the front of everyone. Now remember that everything was open. And so there she was in her bed, and as she tells the story, she had to deal with the fact that she had to go to the bathroom. And the toilet was wide open. So she didn't really want to do that, and so she waited. And she waited, and she waited, and she waited until she just couldn't wait anymore, as she said. And she said she took a deep breath and made her way to the toilet. And she sat down, and as soon as she sat down, a woman approached her and asked her, since they all knew she was a pastor now, if she would pray for her. So she said, I couldn't pee. I prayed. And then she made her way back to her bunk for a while. But she couldn't stand it for very long, she said, because when you gotta go, you gotta go. So she went back to the toilet. And she sat down. And sure enough, a young woman approached her again, a different woman, and asked her to pray for her. And she said, I couldn't pee. I prayed. And then she made her way back to her bunk. She was getting desperate. She waited as long as she could, and then she said, really, when you gotta go, you gotta go. I heard her tell this story. And so for a third time, she made her way to the toilet. She sat down, and again, a woman approached her, asked her, please pray for me, Pastor. And she said, and there, in front of everyone, I prayed and peed at the same time. The toilet became my pulpit, she said. Remember how I said she's serious and she's funny? She never thought anything like that would happen. You see, there was something that everyone in the jail knew that she didn't know. And I don't know who in here has been to jail. You don't have to tell me, but maybe you already know, which is you're not allowed to talk in the bunks. You can only have conversations where the toilets are. So those women knew that, but she didn't know that. She was very clear that she was being in solidarity with everyone there, but she had no idea, actually, what she was doing. Those women were strategic, weren't they? And they found a way to get their needs met. They understood something that she didn't know before. And so once she figured that out, they worked out a system, and she put an envelope on her bed with slips of paper. And they put their prayer requests in the envelope. And she goes, I can pray for my bed just fine. What she says is that in that experience, she was broken open into trust. What she was actually doing in Senator Hutchison's office was protesting the Dream Act. She trusted she was doing the right thing in doing that. Then she got arrested. She was committing civil disobedience, and she trusted that in this act of civil disobedience, though illegal, she was doing the right thing. She was clear about her purpose and where she was headed. She stayed in jail on behalf of all of those people who couldn't, plus those undocumented workers for which she was protesting the Dream Act for. And she trusted that that was what she was called to do. She served time, and she was transferred to that county jail where she'd never been, and she learned the ways of the culture of the jail. She trusted that her sacrifice on behalf of others was what was required at the time, and they saw her, recognized her as a pastor. She began to be in ministry, as I understand many do who enter our prison system with those who are incarcerated. And even though they moved her to the front of the jail, she still felt that she was trusting in this process to do what she was supposed to do. She was pretty confident in all of those actions, but then in the most vulnerable of states, when she actually had to do what everybody else has to do, eventually, we all have to do it, she tried a number of times, and as she said, she pulled back. So at the moment, she actually had no choice, no plan, no image of what God was calling on her to do. That moment was when they asked for prayer. That moment is when she was broken open. She said, when you gotta go, you gotta go. And I'm quoting her, there are systemic issues that we need to get rid of, like peeing. We need it to go and be gone. This was my burning bush moment, she said. This was when I knew that I had to be with these people. And when she's asked, why? Why would you need this? Why would you know this? She said, I thought I had been in solidarity and trust of God, but at that moment, in that posture, I understood that I would have to actually live it. Remember, this was all before she asked to live intentionally on the streets. I would actually have to live it to ever be able to understand it. I think I could not work or advocate anymore on anyone's behalf if I did not know what it was to live it. I just couldn't see it any other way. Dietrich Bonhoeffer might say that God couldn't see it any other way for us either. That God's not going to change the fact that we have to be broken open in places of vulnerability in order to truly know God. That God the hero is not just going to come down and save us out of jail once we've done the right, proper civil disobedience thing. God's going to wait till we're sitting on the toilet and say, this is where you need to be, with these people. Here I am. Trust this. And that's hard. It's really, really hard. So now Lorenza has a bus pass. And this allows her to travel all around and be with people who are homeless, people who live on the margins, who are poor and in exile, undocumented people as well as documented people. She doesn't ever stay in private homes, so if she comes to speak, places host her, she stays in a shelter. And she invites you to stay with her if you want to try and if you can get in the shelter with her. At the beginning of this Lenten season, Lorenza began to fast for 40 days. And so right now she's in the midst, coming to the end of going 40 days without food. She's drinking water and some juice. She has the doctor's care. It's supervised. It's not a hunger strike. It's another way to test her body and to put herself in a trusting relationship with God. As her time without food is extended, sometimes she has to rest more, and you'll see that on her Facebook page. Daily, she's praying and fasting and walking and talking, and right now, today, she's on the border between Guatemala and Mexico, she said. I commented on her Facebook timeline this week. I said, "Your trust in God, Lorenza, permeates your choices to not only make your fast, but in the larger scheme, to request this appointment, to follow your call. I am a witness to the trust you must hold, and I'm watching it grow." And I asked her, "Does it feel as though your trust has grown to you? Has it matured? Has it changed over time as you've answered God's call to ministry?" Here's what she wrote to us. "Hi, Linda. Yes, yes, and yes. I care to name it faith. I give God thanks for the gift of faith. I understand my faith in God not relying on myself, but in having a closer relationship with God, understanding more and more the faithfulness of God in spite of my unfaithfulness. I'm in awe of God's grace for me, and so that natural outpouring present in the Holy Spirit is my faith in God's faithfulness. How can I not have faith in God? P.S. Please pass my greeting to the Table UMC in California. Let them know I'm praying for them and would like to ask for their prayers as well. Blessings, my sister." Writer and mystic and teacher Henri Nouwen speaks to us of the challenges and rewards of how we can place our trust in God. And he writes this: "The great spiritual task facing all of us is to so trust that we belong to God, that we can be free in the world, free to speak even when our words are not received, free to act even when our actions are criticized, ridiculed, or considered useless, free also to receive love from people, and to be grateful for all the signs of God's presence that are out in the world." I think Lorenza would agree with that. But what might it look like if she didn't agree? What might it look like? Remember that passage that Matt read for us just a few minutes ago. In that, we have an example the writer of John gives us of people who may or may not make a choice to be broken open into trust. Matt read it for us from the New Revised Standard Version, which is in our pews. I found another version. It's called the Scarlet Letter Bible. They call it that because, I don't know, some of you know there are Bibles that have supposedly the words of Jesus are in red. That's not really true, but that's one of the ways they're presented. And so this takes that on, and they call themselves the Scarlet Letter Bible. It's written by a biblical scholar and a scientist, one person. It's interesting what their education is. And here is the Scarlet Letter translation of that same passage. "Some heathens went up to the temple to worship during the festival of Passover. They came to Phil, who was from Fisherman's Wharf over in Galilee. He was asking for an appointment with Jesus. Phil went and told Drew, Together, they went to find Jesus. Jesus said, "It's time for the authentic human to be recognized." And I'm telling you, really, if a seed never falls into the earth and disintegrates, it remains just a seed. But if it disintegrates, it's going to produce fruit. If you love your life, you'll lose it. If you let go of your life as it is, your horizons will expand forever. If you want to serve me, you have to do what I do. You have to go where I go. If you do this, God won't let you down. I'm troubled. What am I supposed to say? God keep me from my fate? No, Jesus says. I won't deny the reason I came here in the first place. God, make yourself known. And just then, when he said this, a voice from heaven came saying, "I've made myself known. I'll do it again." And when people heard the voice, some of them thought it was just thunder. Some said that an angel had spoken to him. Jesus said, "That voice isn't for me. It's for you. It's decision time. The world's ruler is about to be sent into exile," speaking of himself. "I'm going to be upheld and everyone will come to me." This was how he was hinting at what was ahead and how he expected to die. That's a different sort of translation, but it says the same thing. And if you notice, the passage both begins and ends with people coming to Jesus, but they're the wrong people, supposedly. They're the outside people, the heathen people, the Gentile people, not the people who were closest to him. The people like the women in the jail who needed help. Those are the ones who approach Philip, who has a Greek name. So maybe that's the entry point, right? They're not the ones who are supposed to be in the know about this man named Jesus, about how to practice the right religion, but they want to talk to him. And when Jesus talks about being raised up, somehow they know what he's talking about. Not the people who are already closest to him, not the right people, but the outsiders, everyone else who is starting to come to him. The people on the outside, you see, often get it, which is what Lorenza now understands. And the people on the outside, they come and they seek Jesus out and they ask questions and they want to learn. The people on the inside so often just keep going day in and day out, thinking we know it all. At the center of this passage is that saying. Did you hear it about the seed? The seed? If it stays on its branch, it's going to wither and die, right? So many of us cling to that branch, though, and don't realize that that creates death. This is the great truth that the religiously inside, those of us, so often fail to grasp. It's not really about Jesus' death and resurrection. It's not. It's really about being willing to let go of that branch. It's really about being willing to follow Jesus into death, into resurrection. What's true for Jesus is true for every human being. You don't go deep by standing still. You can't do it. You can't grow by remaining the same. You can't reach in love by refusing to participate in the movements that are meant to define you and reach to your neighbor in love. You can't get great if you play it safe. You can't stand out by staying in the crowd. Remember our lone nut on the hill. So, once again, it's decision time. How do you want to be? What kind of life do you want to live? Who among us might be ready this day, even right now?